And
David was coming on, but then we lost him. There
he's
he
here.
is.
He's here,
There
Brian.
he
He's just listening. He's on a Disney.
Hello. I got a
Hi, David.
monitor, so I don't have a
Hey,
camera.
David.
All good. All right. And we're going to temporarily put everybody on mute just to get a default of taking out the background noise. I leave it so that you can unmute at will. So please feel free to join in the conversation if you wish. And if you have a camera that works and can join us by camera, I see, even if I'm sharing my screen, I see everybody's faces because I see you on two screens. So I see the sources on one screen and you on the other. You may only see the sources, but you can see me and I can see you. So we're good. All right, we're jumping right in. Okay, everybody see that? You're good at your end? All
Yes.
right. We started last week with a discussion of the latter part or the middle part of Perek Tetzayin, which is the encounter between David and Shimi ben Gera. So let's just back up a little bit, and for the benefit of those who missed last week's class, it is recorded, and I apologize, we got the recording up only last night, but the recording is now posted. I'm just going to quickly kind of bring us all back up to speed as to where we're at. The beginning of the parak, David is leaving Yerushalayim. Actually, in chapter 15 and 16, is the stories of David's flight from Jerusalem as Avshalom is launching his rebellion, is marching towards Yerushalayim. David doesn't wait to find out what is going to be the. Actually, you know what? You can hear me, correct? I'm missing something here. One second. Sorry for the technical delay. Okay, you should still be able to hear me. Okay, I don't know if the quality changed at all, but that is okay. So chapter 15, as we saw before, is kind of all the positive, all the people who come running to David's side to express their support for David, and Dia the Kohanim, and he has, I'm going to, actually, I don't want to jump into that part. The Kohanim come to him, and the Yishai Gitti, the Itai Gitti, you have the Gittites, so the families who come to David's aid, and Hushai Ha'arki, which is David's friend, comes to David's aid, the Kohanim. David sends the Aron back to Yerushalayim, but the chapter has a very positive and a very hopeful feel to it. And then we get to chapter 16, and of course, the atmosphere shifts because not everything in David's world right now is good. On the contrary, David is fleeing from Yerushalayim. His kingdom is coming to an end. Avshalom has launched a successful rebellion, stole the hearts of the people. All of this in the aftermath of David and Bathsheba, and a kind of a punishment for that entire episode. And so David encounters the flip side of that, which is chapter 16. Namely, the first is the conversation with Tziva, Mephibosheth's servant. Mephibosheth, as we know, is the grandson of Shaul, son of Yonatan, who David had gone out of his way to befriend and to bring into the palace, and to who was a cripple, and he kind of looks after him, and he had handed over to Mephibosheth the estate of Shaul as a kind of a tribute to Yonatan. And unfortunately, David encounters Tziva, Mephibosheth's kind of evil servant, and Tziva accuses Mephibosheth of treason and of remaining behind as David leaves Yerushalayim and not being loyal to David, saying that he's waiting for the rebellion to fail, for David to fail, and ultimately for the kingdom to come back to the house of Shaul, namely to him. The tragic lie and accusation against Mephibosheth, and unfortunately, David hears it, listens to it, accepts it, and takes the land away from Mephibosheth and gives it to Tziva. And we spend a good couple of classes talking about why David was in a position to kind of buy this lie from Tziva, and ultimately the consequences of that chait of David and what he ends up and where that ends up happening. So we're going to, that was part one of this parak. Part two of this parak was what we started last week, namely David continues along his kind of flight and he encounters Shimi ben Gera. Shimi ben Gera from the tribe of Binyamin, who comes out cursing and throwing stones at David. Yotzei yatzo mekalel. And he's throwing stones at David and all of David's servants and his army. And he's obviously got supporters because you can't throw stones at an entire army unless you have an army behind you. And this is his accusation. Tzei tzei ish hadamim v'ish hablial. Begone, begone, you man of blood, you wicked man. Heshiv alech Hashem kol dmei beit Shaul asher malachta tachtav. God has repaid you, returned to you, upon you, the house of the blood of the house of Shaul, in whose kingdom you have taken, Ve'yiten Hashem amlucha b'yad Avshalom, and given the kingdom back to somebody else, namely to Avshalom, and you are in your, caught by your own evil, in chaber atecha, ish damim ata, but you are a man of blood. Avishai ben Tsruya, remember David has two generals, Yoav ben Tsruya and Avishai ben Tsruya, both of whom are his nephews, and both of whom are hot-headed zealots who David has to constantly rein in from their activities. So Avishai says to David, Lama yikalel akelav amet azet adoni amelech? Why do you let this dead dog curse the king? Ebanav asir et rosho. Give me the green light, I will take his head off in one fell swoop. And the king's response, of course, is very different. Vayomer HaMelech, Ma li v'lachem b'nei Tzruya? What am I going to do with you, b'nei Tzruya? What have I to do with you? Kol yikalel, let him curse. Ki Hashem amar lo kalel et David. It is as if God has said to him, curse David. Why should I say to God? Who's going to say to God, why do you do this to Shimi? And David now expands his conversation. My own son who came forth from me seeks to destroy me. Now this Benjaminite also. Let him be. Let him curse. It's God who has told him to curse. As if. Maybe God will look at my pain, my iniquity, my suffering here, and repay me with good. Because I tolerated this cursing. And so David and his men continue along the way. And Shimi is walking on the hillside, kind of across from him, either across the valley or top of the valley. Continuing to curse and to throw stones at David and to shame him and to throw dust at him. And this is how David leaves Yerushalayim. With the voice of Shimi ben Gera cursing from the other hillside. And people come with who are with David, the king, and all the people arrived weary. Where they arrived to, we'll talk about at another time. So, this is the story of what we refer to as the story of Shimi ben Gera, who's clearly committing what is, without question, a treasonous accusation against David. It's treasonous because David is still the king. Remember that Avshalom has not yet come to Yerushalayim. Avshalom has not yet become, declared himself king officially. David is still the reigning king. Even if he wasn't, he would still be kind of the previous king. And so this accusation against David, God has repaid you for all the blood of the house of Shaul, whose kingdom you usurped, right? That's really quite an accusation, and it is treasonous by nature. And so in all accounts, David has every right to do it exactly what Avishai ben Tsruya says should be done, which is you stand up for your position as king and take care of him. David does not do so, and this is not the first time that David has had to rein in Avishai and Yoav's exuberance for vengeance. Avishai was the one who David took with him down into the camp of Saul when Saul was chasing him to when Shaul was looking, and Avishai was the one who wanted to take Shaul's head off. So this is the second head that Avishai asks to remove. And David's response to Avishai then was the same. What am I going to do with you, B'nai Tzruya? And the only difference here is that that Yoav is not on the scene, but essentially the same reaction he has to Yoav, who is guilty of killing the general of Shaul, namely Avner ben Ner. David puts David in a very difficult political position, and he has to kind of distance himself from that murder. Yoav and Avishai are very difficult, zealous kind of generals. David has to constantly rein them in. And that's exactly what you have here. Nonetheless, we spent the discussion last week, and we're going to continue from where we left off, trying to understand this accusation against against David, that called Shiva Lech Hashem called me Beit Shaul Hashir Malach Tachtav. God has repaid you for all of the blood of the house of Saul. That's quite an astounding accusation. To say to David that David took the reign of the kingdom, and David took the kingdom away from Shaul by blood, by murder, by killing the house of Shaul, that's an extraordinary accusation. And certainly one that places Shimon ben Gera into the category of one of the main enemies of David. Eventually, David will deal with Shimon ben Gera, but only on his deathbed by handing over to Shlomo one of his areas of responsibility, which is to address Shimon ben Gera's treasonous accusations and the beginning of Sefer Melachim. But this is still our challenge today, to understand what this is about. So we offered several possibilities last week. One was that it's a reference, as the Mefarshim suggest, to two murders that were critical in the ascension of David to the throne, and that might have been attributed to David were David not to have gone out of his way to distance himself from. Let me repeat that sentence. Two murders of key players in the house of Shaul, whose death could have and should have and maybe did lead to the reign of David upon the kingdom, on the throne, and whose blood could have been attributed to David, but were not. Meaning by David is public distancing himself from that moment. What am I referring to? So Mefarshim, almost unanimously, all the commentaries I shared with you the source page last week, the Radach, the Malbim, Barbanel, Balbag, they all essentially see this kind of experience of David as a form of punishment for his past sins, in this case, the story of Bathsheba. And the blood that we are referring to, most Mefarshim suggest, is the blood of Avner and Ishbosheth. You can throw Uriah Hiti into the mix, although Uriah is a different story. But of the house of Shaul, particularly Avner and Ishbosheth. So Avner and Ishbosheth, that's what we spoke about last week. Avner was the general of Ishbosheth. Ishbosheth, son of Shaul, was the heir to the throne of Shaul after the Shaul's death. And the beginning chapters of Shmuel Bet, which was the civil war between those who followed the house of Shaul and those who were loyal to David. The Navi had sided with David, but nonetheless, the army had sided with Shaul and his son Ishbosheth. Avner was the general in charge of the army of Ishbosheth. And at some point or another, Avner chooses to leave Ishbosheth's side, come over to David and kind of reunite the kingdom together and end the civil war. David accepts it, embraces him, And lo and behold, the result is that Yoav ben Tsruya, Abishai's brother, comes in from the field, accuses David of being naive to Avner's duplicity, and he goes running out into the field, catches up to Avner, and murders him in cold blood, despite the fact that David had embraced him. That puts David in an extraordinarily difficult position, and David has to go out of his way to publicly denounce Yoav and denounce the murder of Avner, and to sit Shiva for Avner, and to tear Kriya for Avner, and to show the entire world that he had nothing to do with the death of Avner. And everybody accepted David's word for it, except for, of course, those loyal to the house of Shaul, in this case, Sheva Megera, who may have accepted David's account of the story at the time, but now that David is running from Yerushalayim, Shimi ben Gera from the house of Shaul, Mishpachat Beit Shaul, comes running out and says to the entire world, you see, David, you were guilty of killing Avner ben Ner in cold blood. God is repaying your actions. The other death that is in question is Ishbosheth himself. Ishbosheth ben Shaul was killed by two members of the tribe of Givon, and we'll talk about the Givonim in a moment. Two tribes from the Givonim who came and murdered Ishbosheth in his bed while he was sleeping in the middle of the day, taking his siesta. And they take the head, they chop off his head, and they bring the head to David. And they bring the head to David, and they say to David, here is the head of your enemy, referring to Ishbosheth. And David is so angered by these two people who had the audacity, thinking back to all the times that David could have killed Shaul, and had every right to kill Shaul. But he wouldn't touch him because he was the anointed of God. He was the Mashiach Hashem. And here, Echav and Banah go and they murder Ishbosheth in the middle of the night, in the middle of the day, while he's sleeping. We'll talk about stabbing somebody in the back. So he immediately kills Echav and Banah, accuses them of killing the king, and thus distances himself from that moment. But at the end of the day, David comes to the throne because Ishbosheth died. And Ishbosheth died because he was killed, ostensibly in the name of David. So it's not hard to imagine a long-standing grudge against David launched here in the accusation of treason by Shimi ben Gera, who says to David, you killed the house of Shaul to assume the throne. You killed Ishbosheth and you killed Avner. Even though David didn't kill Ishbosheth, and he didn't kill Avner, and he had nothing to do with those murders, and he had nothing to do with wanting them dead. But nonetheless, that is the accusation. There's another possibility that we suggested, which is really, extreme, but there is also the possibility that in Shimon Megera's mind, David has also been guilty of killing the rest of the royal family once he became king, which was not uncommon in the days of Tanakh. Avimelech in Sefer Shoftim does so to the house of Yerubal. Ataya tries to do that to the house of David. Baasha does that to the house of Yeravam. Yehu does that to the house of Achav. We went through a number of these cases on the source page. If you look at them, that was all part of last week's discussion. And if that's part of his agenda or that is his impression, then that's certainly false. If that is no question. It's a totally false accusation against David. To say to David that David not only usurped the throne and took it by the death of Avshalom, the death of Avner and Ishbosheth, but then he went out and killed the royal family. That's absurd. David did not kill anybody from the royal family. On the contrary, look what he did to Mephibosheth, the Yeshol's grandson, to bring him into the palace and to make him give him a seat at the table, all because he was the son of Yonatan. And that's more or less what we got up to last week. However, as I said last week, the notion that David is guilty of, or the accusation against David that he has the blood of the royal family on his hands, not just Ishbosheth and Avner, but the blood of the royal family as a whole, may not be so crazy a accusation after all. I to compare it to all of the examples that I cited before, that's evil, because he certainly didn't do anything of that sort. However, there is one story in which David is, at least in the eyes of Binyamin and the house of Shaul, the relatives of Shaul, David is not so innocent. The problem is the Mefarshim do not identify this particular story in any way associated with this moment, because the Mefarshim, and I think I've mentioned this before, consistently, actually I can stop sharing for this part of the discussion, just because I can. The Mefarshim consistently look at the chapters of Shmuel Bet in chronological order. They are generally very hesitant to attempt to rearrange the chronological sequence of the chapters of Shmuel Bet. And we've seen that. We saw that in various contexts. However, let's call them contemporary scholars, which I think more or less, even those out of the world of the Beit Midrash, certainly saw when see the last couple of chapters of Sefer Shmuel as chronologically out of sequence. And so, and this we've looked at, I'm just going to jump back into it for a second. We saw that from chapter 21, chapter 20 of Shmuel Bet has a kind of an ending to it. Lists all of the names of the generals in David's army, a kind of assessment of David's world, Yoav ben Alatzava, and etc. And then in Shmuel Bet Perek Chav Aleph starts, Vayhi Ra'avi Me David Shalosh Shanim, there's a famine in the days of David for 3 years. That story is part of a series of chapters, chapter 21, 22, 23, and 24, the last four chapters of the book of Sefer Shmuel, that are clearly chronologically out of place. Now, how do I know this is out of place? Because this story has to do with the reburial of Shaul. That's much earlier. We're going to go through the details of it in a second. But the reburial of Shaul is a much earlier story. It's about Shaul and about Shaul's war on the Givonim, and we're going to come to it. But that's clearly not happening after Avshalom's rebellion. Right? That is a very early story. Second chapter in this sequence is the Shira, the song that David sings, and the day that God saved him from the hands of his enemies and from the hands of Shaul. This is a song of David that David wrote as part of Tehillim, that's part of his experience when he's running from Shaul. That has nothing to do with the end of Shmuel Bet. If anything, it belongs in Shmuel Aleph. Similarly, chapter 23 is a list of the Giborim, the Shemot Giborim Asher David, the names of all of the people in David's army. This is 300 and 600 and all of his men and his army. David's army is described in great fanfare and detail, including Uriah HaChiti, which is the end of this list. That's certainly not happening now. Uriah HaChiti is before Batsheva. So this chapter is also clearly out of sequence. And the description in chapter 24, which is David's attempt to count the army, the size of the army, numbering by the tens of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, by tribe, that's also not part of the end of David's life. He comes back from Yerushalayim, from his exile after the death of Avshalom, a broken king. There's no story post the rebellion of Avshalom of any power and stature to David. So this story of David counting the strength of his army, that also has no place here at the end of the story. It is also part of a series of chapters, four in fact, 21, 22, 23, and 24, that are a postscript to the story, and they are all earlier stories. When we get to that section of Shmuel Bet, we are going to have to identify each one and place it in its proper chronological moment. All right? But they're earlier stories. Why do I say that? Because there is one story here, which we actually studied once before in the context of Mephibosheth, which has a very almost tragic role that David is forced to play. And this is really where I want to focus for a moment on. And it could very well be that Shimi ben Gera's taunt to David, when he says to David, "You are guilty for the blood of the house of Shaul, which is now coming back to bite you, to haunt you," then he could in fact be referring not to Avshalom, not to Avner, and not to Ishbosheth, but he could be referring to this episode here. So let's review it for this context. Va'yira'av bimei David shalosh shanim shana achrei shana. A famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year. Now you understand a famine in the land of Israel means a drought, no rain. A famine in Israel with no rain for 3 years means that people are dying. Right? This, it's not a famine meaning prices have gone up, inflation's gone a little high, and the playing with interest rates. This is a famine means there's no rain, there's no water, and people are dying. Vayivakesh David et bnei Hashem, and David sought God's face, meaning he prayed to God and he beseeched God, and he's seeking to understand what is it that's causing this famine. And eventually, this samach is a representative of a kind of a space pause in the text. New paragraph. Vayomer Hashem, God answered him and said, El Shaul ve'el Beit Hadamim al asher himit et ha-givonim. This is happening because of Saul and the blood on Saul's house for having put to death the Givonim. Now, okay. So what are we talking about? What do you mean the blood on Shaul's hands for having killed the Givonim? So let's go one step further. Vayikra ha-melech la-givonim. So David called over the Givonim and said to the remnants, whoever was left of the Givonim, and said to them, parenthetically. Okay, so opening up a parenthesis here. Via Givonim, this is an open parenthesis. Via Givonim, lo mibnei Yisrael hema. The Givonim were not Israelites. Ki'im miyeter ha'emori. They were remnants of the Canaanite tribe of the Amorites. Uvnei Yisrael nishbu lehem vayivakesh. And Israel had taken an oath of loyalty and alliance with them. Anybody remember when Israel took an alliance with a peace treaty, an alliance and a brit with the Givonim? How far back do we have to go to remember that story? Anybody want to venture a guess?
Sure.
2 points to our friends in Calgary. 3 points. That was a long, that was a good, that was a three-pointer. Yehoshua. Mm-hmm. Yehoshua. Sefer Yehoshua. All the way back then. The first, they were the tribe that disguised themselves to pretend that they were from a faraway place, and they come to Yehoshua and they say, "We're from a faraway land and we want to make a breach with you. We're not from the local Canaanites." And then they make a breach with them, and then they discover that they were from the local Canaanites. And so they decide to keep that breach with them anyway. And if you remember, what was the end of that story? What did they do with them?
They got some food out of it.
Excuse me?
They got some food out of it.
They got some food out of it, meaning?
Well, they were hungry, they wanted food.
But they were disguising themselves as if they had come. This is Yeshua Paraktet, Yoshve Givon, inhabitants of Givon heard all that God had done for Yeshua, and they knew that they were going to wage war on the Canaanites, so they pretended that they were from a faraway land. They put on sackcloth and they pretend they took dry wineskins and torn clothes and torn shoes, and they pretended. They came and they said that we're from a faraway land, and make a brit with us. They do so. And in the end, they find that they are from the next hill over outside of Yerushalayim area, today known as Telstone. They heard that they were really close, and so they went, and they found them in their cities. Givon, Kfira, Beirut. Beirut is the city from which Rechav and Baana came. And what do they end up doing? So this is the critical piece. So Israel did not, in fact, go and smite them, destroy them, despite, right, even though they were, A, they had every right to, because they were Canaanites, and B, they had deceived them, but rather, they had taken an oath. And so they kept that oath. They remained loyal to that oath. And what did they do with them? So this is what they said. Let them become hewers of wood and drawers of water for the congregation. And in fact, that is where they ended up. And in Sefer Melachim, it talks about them having been placed in the service of the temple or of the Mikdash. So they ended up in the service of the Mishkan, which is why here in the last pasuk, Yeshua gave them the role of being the choppers of wood and the drawers of water for the congregation, ulemizbach Hashem, and for the altar. Now, the fact that they were by the altar is identified by the Mefarshim as to when Shaul went and destroyed them. Vayivakesh Shaul lahakotam. Shaul, in his zeal, sought to slay them in his zeal for the children of Israel and Judah. What act of zeal are we referring to? So it's unclear when Shaul killed the people of the Givonim. The Mefarshim suggest that it was when he killed the city of Nov and destroyed the Mishkan in Nov and killed the Kohanim and destroyed the families of Nov, because if in fact the Givonim were encamped and had a role in the Mishkan, as it says in Yoshua, then when Shaul went in his zeal and destroyed the city of Nov, which is where the Mizbeach was, then, or where the Mishkan was, then he would have done so to the Givonim as well. So Shaul has on his record the execution, the murder of the city of Nov and the Kohanim of Nov and the people, the women and children of Nov. And now we're finding out for the first time at the very end of the book that he also has on his record the blood of the Givonim. Now, that piece of information is relevant and important to understand why David was so angry at the two Givonites, who had killed Ishbosheth ben Shaul, because he accused them of not acting for the sake of Israel, but acting out of revenge for against the house of Shaul. You understand that motives become very murky in this world. Okay, everybody with me so far? We're doing a lot of jumping around, so but this is important. So David calls over the Givonim. And he says to them, Ma'aselachem, what can I do to appease you? U'bame'achaper, how can I bring atonement for what Shaul had done to you? U'vachud nachalat Hashem, so that you may bless the land of God and we may end this famine. V'yom alo ha'givonim. So the Givonites said to David, and here's the critical piece, Ein lanu Kesef v'zahavim Shaul, we have no manner of claim for gold and silver against the house of Shaul, v'im beto. V'ein lanu ish lamit b'Yisrael, we have no desire to put to death any of Israel. So David says, v'yomer ma'atem omrim, what do you want to say? As whatever you want, I'll do. Aseh lechem. Lesson learned, case in point, never commit to something before you know what you're committing yourself to. This is what they said. Aish asher kilanu, the man that destroyed us, meaning Shaul, v'asher dimalanu, and devised against us, nishmadnu mityatzev b'chogvu Yisrael, so that we have been destroyed from any kind of presence in the borders of Israel. Yitan lanu shiva anashim mibanav. Give us 7 of his children. V'hoka'anum la'Hashem b'givat sha'ul b'chir Hashem. And we will hang them in Giva of Shaul, chosen of God. Essentially, give us 7 of Shaul's descendants, and we will kill them publicly in a public hanging. And that will appease us. Why 7? Not our issue for now. V'yomer ha'melech ani eten. And the king agrees. Now, this pay means that there's a lengthy pause between the request and the answer, because David responds, but you understand the pain of David's response. And David, who had refused to lay a hand against Shaul, would let Shaul live twice, even though Shaul was out to kill him. And here David has now become king, and Shaul had exacted a terrible vengeance against the people of Givon. God had said to David, you need to appease the Givonim in some way. When David finally finds the Givonim and he talks to them, he finds out what they really want is to publicly execute 7 of Shaul's grandchildren.
Now this could make Michal really hate him. Or is this before?
No, that's not, has nothing to do with Michal. But it is complicated.
It does say 5 sons of Michal.
We'll get to that in a second. They're not Michal's children. We'll come to that in a second. The king says, I will deliver them to you.
Now, why, of course, would Hashem want that?
Excuse me?
So strange that Hashem agreed to that. That was the request, that Hashem told them to go and do whatever the Givonim want.
Correct. It's a very shocking story, but again, and we don't know all the answers. We don't really have a good answer to the question of why, except that in the language of Tanakh, this at some point or another, the Givonim, there was a terrible crime committed against the Givonim, and there needed to be some recognition of that crime. Now, why the grandchildren of Shaul pay the price for it, we don't have an answer to that question, but that is, in fact, what we have. That was the dilemma placed before David. Okay, so we understand how difficult a dilemma it is, and I think it is reflected in David's hesitation, but at the end of the day, David saw this as a mandate, and so he agrees. But at the same time, Yachmol HaMelech HaMephibosheth ben Yonatan ben Shaul, amongst the grandchildren that was there, he spared Mephibosheth, because Mephibosheth, he had a special oath of loyalty to Yonatan over Mephibosheth, al shvat Hashem asher ben Natan ben David ben Yonatan ben Shaul. And so there is a, he spares Mephibosheth. We read this parak the first time, we were trying to figure out when David and Mephibosheth first met, back in chapter 9. Vaykach HaMelech, and here it comes to the question that Debbie raised before. Vaykach HaMelech et shnei b'nei ritzpa bat aya asher yalda l'shaul et armoni v'et Mephibosheth. David took the 2 sons of Ritzpa bat aya. Ritzpa bat aya, we'll see in a minute, was Shaul's Pilegesh. And she had two children, Armoni and Mephibosheth, which is a different Mephibosheth than the Mephibosheth ben Shaul, ben Yonatan, not to confuse them. Ve'et chameshet b'nei Michal bat Shaul asher yalda l'Adriel ben Barzillai Mecholati. And 5 of the children of Michal bat Shaul, who she bore to Adriel ben Barzillai Mecholati. So just open parentheses, this verse is very complicated, because if you remember the story of David and Michal, it says at the end of that story that Michal had no children.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly there are 5 children from Michal to Adriel ben Barzillai. That was one part of the problem. The other part of the problem is Michal was never married to Adriel ben Barzillai. Michal, in the interim between the time she married David the first time and the time she comes back to David, was given to Palti ben Laish. Remember that story. Who was married to Adriel ben Barzillai? Merav, Michal's sister. So all the Mefarshim agree, based on the Gemara, that this is not five children of Michal, it's five children of Merav. Why are they called children of Michal? So the Mefarsha said, because maybe Michal raised them, maybe Michal had a hand in raising them, maybe Michal had influence over them, maybe they grew up in the house of Michal, or maybe the Navi wanted us to kind of connect this to Michal. But at some level, we need to recognize that Adriel ben Barzillai was the husband of Merav, not of Michal. So that, just as an FYI, with regard to the story of Michal. But that's all parenthetical. Seven grandchildren. And he handed them to the Givonim. Now the Givonim, and the Givonites hanged them. Now, did David kill them? Let's just be very clear here. Did David kill these seven grandchildren of Shaul?
Sort of.
Okay. So in modern sensibility in politics, we'd say, well, he's responsible. The buck stops there. He's the king. But in the world of Tanakh, did David actually kill them? No. What he did was handed them over to the Givonim on God's command or on God's instruction, so to speak. So there is some confusion here, and we'll come back to Shimon ben Gera in a moment. Vayiplu shvatam yachad, and the seven of them were killed together. They were put to death at the beginning of the harvest. Why do I care when they were put to death? Beginning of the harvest? Because we'll see in a moment, the story of Ritzpah Bat Aya goes from the beginning of the harvest until the end of the winter, until the beginning of the rains, which means the entire season of 6 months from Pesach to Sukkot. As they are hanging, and the Givonim left them hanging because that's what the Givonim wanted for all to see, Batikach Ritzpah Bat Aya. Ritzpah Bat Aya is described in Chazal in extraordinary terms of her chesed and her tzidkus. Batikach Ritzpah Bat Aya Tasak. She took sackcloth, Batateu Le'elatzur, and spread it upon the rock. Mitchilat Katzir Ad Nitachmayim Aleim Neshemayim. From the beginning of the harvest until the rains started to pour. And throughout that period of time, she encamped on that rock, outside, in the heat of the desert sun, Bilon natna of Hashemayim lanuch alahem yomam et chayat sadeh laila, protecting the bodies of these seven grandchildren, not letting the birds of prey feast on them or the beasts at night, but to protect the cover, the dignity, and the of the mace of these seven people who are still. Either they were on the ground already or they were on the tree, but she protected them from the nivel of the animals. Why is it relevant? Because this story of Ritzpah Bat Aya completely transforms David. David hears what Ritzpah Bat Aya, Shaul's concubine, did out of covered respect to the bodies of these seven grandchildren, and realized at that moment that there's a second avla, there's a second story embedded in this that is an injustice that David himself is guilty of, which is, where is at this moment in time, where is the body of Shaul HaMelech? So remember, that's why I said this is an early story. The body of Shaul HaMelech, who fell on Mount Gilboa in the war with the Plishtim, had been captured by the Philistines and taken to the temple in Gaza, in the city of either Gaza or in Gat, to display before the Plishtim from the walls. And the people of Yavesh Gilad, which is a tribe, subset of Manasseh, sitting on the east side of the Jordan, who had a long-standing debt of to Shaul for having Shaul's first battle was to defend the people of Yavesh Gilad. The people of Yavesh Gilad heard that the body of Shaul had been so desecrated, they ran to Eretz Plishtim in a raid, captured the body of Shaul, and brought him back to burial in Yavesh Gilad. That story is in the beginning of Shmuel. In the end of Shmuel, beginning of Shmuel Bet, or end of Shmuel Aleph, Vayelach David vayikach et atzmot Shaul et atzmot Yonatan beno me'et balei Yavesh Gilad, So David went and he took the bones of Shaul and the bones of Yonatan from Yavesh Gilad, asher ganvu otam mirchov Beit Shan, asher tla'um shama plishtim. The Yavesh Gilad had stolen them back from the square of Beit Shan where the Philistines had hanged them. B'yom akot plishtim et Shaul b'Gilboa, from that battle on Har Gilboa. And to protect and give them some dignity, they took them and buried them in Yavesh Gilad. But they really need to be buried in the ancestral land of Shaul of the house of Kish. And so David goes finally to bring Shaul to a proper state burial. Vayal mishamet atzmot Shaul v'atzmot Yonatan. So he takes the bones of Shaul and the bones of Yonatan, miyasvut atzmot amukaim, and the bones of those that were hanged, the seven grandchildren from the Givonim. Vayikbulut atzmot Shaul v'Yonatan v'no be'eretz Binyamin b'tzela b'kever Kish Aviv, and he brings them all to burial in the area of the ancestral land of Kish. They did as the king had commanded. And then God accepted the prayers of Israel and brought rain to the land. That's the story of the Givonim in Perek Aleph. Now, there's a positive and a negative to the story. Obviously, David's role in this is very complicated. On the one hand, we don't understand why God allowed the Givonim this act of revenge. On the other hand, what Shaul had done, nobody asks the question. People ask why God let the people of Givon have this act of revenge, but we don't always process how evil Shaul had been to the Givonim. To take a people with whom there was a brit, with whom there was a covenant, with whom there was a peace treaty for hundreds of years, and to slaughter them out of zeal because he wants to kind of create the purity of the Israelite nationality. And rid them of all the Canaanite remnants. Shaul's behavior was inexcusable. So there's a complex world. The story of the Givonim is very complex. But into it, David is mired in a role that he had no business being in. He didn't want to be here, and he certainly didn't want to hand over these seven grandchildren of Shaul to the Givonim. And yet that's the position that God seems to have put him in at that moment. The hero, or in this case, heroine of the story is Ritzpah bat Aya. And she transforms not only the story, but she also, in a way, redeems David, because David realizes from her righteousness and her devotion to Kavod HaMeis, realizes that there's another avla in the story. The other injustice is that David has not done enough to bring the remnants of, so I'm going to stop sharing for a second, to bring the remnants of Shaul and his family to proper state burial in their estate. And so from Ritzvah Bat Aya's example, David goes, takes the seven grandchildren, takes Shaul, takes Yonatan, and brings them to proper burial in their ancestral land, which is core to a value system in Tanakh, that the person should always be buried in their ancestral land. It's one of the reasons why the land of Mephibosheth, given to Tziva, taken away from Tziva, right? That's the ancestral land of Shaul. Why that plays such a critical story? Because that's exactly where Shaul is buried. It's that land that we're talking about. So that's the story of the Givonim. Now, is it possible that as David is leaving Yerushalayim, out comes Shimi ben Gera in the house of Binyamin? And this is a story that's years later, right? The story of the burial of Shaul is early in David's career as king. This is years later. Everybody around has long since forgotten the story of the Givonim. The only one who hasn't forgotten the story of the Givonim is David, because he has Mephibosheth sitting at his table. And his loyalty to Mephibosheth is on two levels. His loyalty to Mephibosheth is in part due to his loyalty to Yonatan, but it's also in part because he spared Mephibosheth from the vengeance of the Givonim. And when Rechab and Baanah tried to execute Ishbosheth, they themselves were Givonites, and David literally takes their heads off for it. And you understand that there's a complexity here. And years later, David is running from Yerushalayim, fleeing for out of the rebellion of Avshalom, and comes along Shimon ben Gera standing on the hilltop. And what does he say to what does he say about David? Now let's go back to the story. What does Shimon ben Gera say? Say, say, Isha tamim be'isha blial. Be gone, you man of blood, you wicked man. Heshiv alech Hashem et kol dmei beit Shaul asher malachta tachtav. God has returned upon you, repaid you for the blood of the house of Shaul, whom you have reigned in his place. So the Mefarshim say the blood of the house of Shaul is Avner and Ishbosheth. Maybe. But is it also possible that Shimon ben Gera in his mind and David in what he's hearing is also conjuring up the memory of that moment when David was responsible for the death of seven of Shaul's grandchildren out of revenge against revenge. Meaning revenge against vengeance. Meaning Givanim had a long-standing gripe against Shaul because Shaul had an act of vengeance against the Givanim. So in response, they wanted the seven grandchildren of Shaul. And David was caught in the middle of that and forced into some kind of complex role of complicity in that act. And everybody else has long since forgotten it, partially because David himself didn't kill them, but at the same time, says Shimon ben Gera, from the house of Shaul, some distant relative, you killed the people of the house of Shaul, the grandchildren of Shaul, included in the list, Avner and Yoav, and seven of the grandchildren of Shaul are in your hands. And you have the audacity to sit on his throne. That's the accusation of Shimon ben Gera. So, as long as David remained, loyal in all facets to God's command, and he remains on the throne by virtue of his righteous, loyal devotion to God, so that story can be excused to some level by virtue of the fact that he was following God's instructions. But the moment David is guilty of Chet Batsheva and the cover-up of Batsheva and the murder of Uriah and subsequently the story of Yudan Tamar and allowing the system of judgment, of justice in the country to collapse, and now Avshalom has launched a full-scale rebellion. And now David is fleeing for his life. What comes back to haunt David isn't just the story of Batsheva, but a long list of those actions that are, at good times, questionable. But in bad times, get lumped together with everything else. And now Shimon ben Gera has got a list 10 people long, Avner and Yoav and the seven grandchildren of Shaul, and maybe throw Uriah Chiti in there as well, said the Mefarshim. And now he's got a list. But it starts with the fact that David, you veered from the core message of loyalty to God that gave you the right to sit on that throne. The moment that loyalty was challenged, and the moment you violated that integrity, then you're fleeing for your life from the throne. So I'm going to lump onto that moment every other transgression or questionable act that you have done in your reign as king. So now here's Shimon ben Gera standing on the hilltop saying, say, say, Isha damim, Isha blial, you worthless, evil man, God has repaid you for all the blood of the house of Shaul. And Avishai ben Tzruya pipes up and says, this guy is guilty of treason. I'll take his head off in one fell swoop. What does David say? Let him be. Let him speak. Let him speak his mind. Let him speak his heart. Let him say what he has to say. Call you Kalil. Let him curse. Yeshem amar lo Kalil at David. God said to him, curse David. What God said to him, curse David? No, what says David? What are you going to say? You're going to second guess God? I never second guess God a day in my life. God told me to do some very questionable things. I didn't second guess God. I violated that trust. I'm now in exile for it. Maybe God will see my angst and have mercy upon me. Maybe he won't. We already talked about the fact that David has completely accepted whatever judgment God decrees for him, precisely for this reason. That David recognizes this is not an accident. Shimon ben Gera has legitimate claims to him. And what is David going to say? He's going to defend himself? Now David suddenly is going to say, no. Now is not the time for David to stand up and say, I am not guilty of those seven grandchildren of Shul because God said to me I should do it. This is not the moment that is what David is going to say. No, I had an excuse. I had a reason. I did it because of X, Y, and Z. This is the moment of all of moments in David's life when his only mandate is to accept whatever consequences God throws his way for all the mistakes of his kingdom and for all the mistakes of his life. Because that's what's happening right now. David is fleeing for his life. David's life as a king is over from his perspective. And he accepts it and he knows it and it's his own fault. It's partially because of the story of Bathsheba. And on top of the story of Bathsheba and of Uriah Hittite, you can throw all of the other things that David ever did wrong, says Shimon ben Gera, including the house of Shaul because of the story of the Givonim. Who remembered the story of the Givonim from 20 years ago? You know who remembered it? Shimon ben Gera and David. So David says to Avishai, this is the moment for us to become totally accepting of whatever happens to us, because that's the moment that God has placed us in. And that's his reaction. And it's very powerful that, you know, that notion, this pasuk, we didn't really talk much about this pasuk, but the reference here, he says, where is it? Koye kalel ki Hashem amar lo kalel at David umi amar madua sitaken. Let him curse, because God has said to him, curse David. God has made this happen. I'm going to accept it. And there's a concept here that is very important, very powerful, which is that there are moments in our life when we perceive kind of the actions against us that we feel an injustice for. We feel that we don't deserve. We feel that the people are being, harsh to us, that we don't deserve what happens to us. In David's case, he felt that he did deserve it, but that's a separate issue. But this notion of acceptance, because ultimately you see or you feel that this is by God's decree, it's a very powerful theological moment for David, the spiritual moment for David. We say it every single day, three times a day. We don't even realize sometimes what we're saying. We make exactly the same claim or articulate the same value every time we daven Shmoneh Esrei. I'll show you a simple tefillah. Let's pull up.
I think that at certain points of David's life, he doesn't accept when somebody's out to get him, right? So,
like when?
From other points of his life. Well, people have attacked him his whole life, like especially when he was younger, and he always fought them. But this time, he's just letting the guy curse him. I mean,
who, give me an example
of someone who cursed him or someone who attacked him.
Somebody who he fought against who attacked him.
Shaul would be one. I mean, like,
he never lifted a finger. That's my whole point.
All the police team.
The police team were enemies. I'm talking about
exactly.
The police team were enemies. I'm talking about where he felt a where he, I'm not talking about where he's fighting against some enemies, because that's what the rule, a leader of Israel does. He protects his people from enemies. You talk about Shaul. Shaul attacked him many times. Did David ever fight back against Shaul?
No.
On the contrary, he went out of his way, and twice he had the opportunity to defend himself against Shaul by killing Shaul. He refused to do so.
No, I guess not.
Enemies are a different story. You know, when you're dealing with the Plishtim, it's a different world. Right? The Ammonites and the Moabites and the enemies of Israel. That's what the role of a leader is to do. But okay. David's acceptance of the circumstances that he's been put in from the moment Natan says to him, "Atah Ish," and he says, "Chatati LaHashem," David's world is one of complete, what we refer to in the halacha as kabbalat adin. Whatever God's decree of judgment is, I accept. And that's been, to a fault, because he's allowed certain things to happen that should never have been allowed to happen, because he saw his role as not being able to defend his own position in this regard, like the story of Amnon and Tamar. But certainly, what he's going to do is stand up and say to Shimon ben Gera, who actually has a legitimate claim, right? From his perspective, from the house of Binyamin, they have a legitimate claim against David. They have a claim against David in terms of what he did with the Givonim. And what's David going to say at this point? I did so because God told me to. I did so because it was the right, because the Kohen told me that, yeah, at the time that was correct. But now, as he's running for his life, and the Aron is back in Yerushalayim, and to say at this point in his life to say God said I have to appease the house of the house of the Gibbonim, at this point in his life, it's meaningless. On the contrary, and David is in a position where, in the aftermath of his chait, he lives with that sense of acceptance of the consequences of his actions to a point where literally he accepts whatever God throws in his path. And he sees Shimon ben Gera in exactly the same way. Let him curse because God is telling him to curse. And God isn't saying anything to Shimon ben Gera. And it's an important distinction to make when you think about the notion of God's role in our lives, the argument that this is happening because God is making it happen, and therefore I accept it, works when you're talking about things that happen to you. It doesn't work when you try to use that argument to defend things that you do. Meaning, and that's the dilemma that David has, right? On the one hand, David is at the time of the Givonim, that's exactly what happened to David. David was put in a position where Hashem said to him, go to the Givonim and appease them. And that included in David's worldview and understanding whatever the Givonim requested. Now, was that the right decision or wrong decision? We'll never know. But now to come along and say, well, you know what, God has told me to do it, that becomes very complicated. And so if he would have defended himself to Shimon ben Gera, it would become even more complicated. So at this point in his life, he does the exact opposite. He says, whatever God says, I accept. We say it in the davening every day. Take a look at this tefillah. It's really extraordinary. We don't always stop to think of what we're saying, but it's very powerful. In the last paragraph of the Shemoneh Esrei, it's actually the postscript to the Shemoneh Esrei, we have a series of tefillot that are all independent of each other, that are composed by Chazal and put together. But there we say the following: Elokai, Nitzor l'shoni mera, God, my tongue from evil, Usfatai midaber mera, God, my lips, that they should speak deceit. Vilamekalelai, and to those who curse me, nafshi tidom, let my soul be silent. Vinafshi ki'afar lakol tiyeh, and let my soul be like dust before everyone else. So what does it mean, lemekalelai, right? We ask God to protect us from speaking evil, to protect our lips from speaking deceitfully. We want God to help us not to speak deceitfully. But there are others who do speak deceitfully. There are others who speak curses. And they even may direct the curses against me. So am I saying to God, well, protect my lips from speaking evil, and then for those who curse me, God, have vengeance against them, right? No. Those who curse me, let my soul be silent. Let my soul be like dust. And therefore, open my mouth in Torah and in mitzvot and in learning, etc. This is all those who do evil, who think evil against me, God, disrupt their intent. Okay? We can hope. But as far as a reaction to them directly, it's complicated. There are times when we have to respond. There are times when we have to react. There are times when we can't allow ourselves to just roll over and let our enemies curse us, etc. But at the same time, there's a moment when we recognize that there's a hand of God in this, and therefore we accept what God places in our path. Very delicate balance. When to play each role. That's the challenge David plays at this moment in his life. And that's exactly the situation David is placed in when he's standing and watching Shimi ben Gera being guilty of treason, but his treason is directed at an accusation against him, which rings so true in his own mind and in his own soul. And therefore, despite all of his efforts to the contrary, and therefore he says, let him be. And he tolerates this curse of Shimi ben Gera. Now, what will end up happening as time progresses is Shimon ben Gera is going to make some critical mistakes. And we'll see them later in chapter 19 and beginning of Sefer Melachim. And to those mistakes, David will turn to Shlomo and have him address. But for right now, this is that moment, sort of the picture, the contrast to the previous chapter, is this image of Shimon ben Gera, of David, leaving Yerushalayim with the voices of Shimon ben Gera ringing out in the public loudspeaker of the people of Israel, accusing him of all of those times when David's behavior was, in the eyes of the people of Binyamin, questionable. And that's the atmosphere, or the tragic atmosphere, by which David begins his trek away from Yerushalayim. So that's where we left off. The rest of this parak will deal with the scene will shift again. And the rest of this parak will deal with Avshalom when Avshalom comes to Yerushalayim. And so we will, Bezrat Hashem, deal with that subject over the next 2 weeks. Word of housekeeping is that we have two more Monday classes before we're going to break for the summer. So tonight, not with included, but next week we'll have a class, and the week after that. So another 2 weeks after tonight, I'll announce it and I'll send it out by email also. But then we will adjourn for the summer and we convene Bezrat Hashem in the fall. So thank you for listening and thank you for your time. And if you have any questions, we have 3 minutes left.
Thank you.
We have to remember all this for next year.
Well, it all gets repeated and reviewed over the course of time as things progress.